Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, the 11th of August 2018. This is episode 4, and I'll just continue reading as part of cardiac rehab. Stonehenge was a Welsh burial site. No author for this one. Some of the bodies buried at Stonehenge in southern England may have come from hundreds of kilometres away in Wales. It has been assumed that individuals whose cremated remains were found at the site were locals. Now a new technique of analysing such remains has found that some came from the same area as the first standing stones at the site, West Wales. Strontium isotopic analysis can tell what food someone was mainly eating in the last decade before they died. The strontium is from strontium, and strontium means a fairy's nose, and it's in the alkaline earths, going beryllium, magnesium, calcium, strontium, probably barium. I think that's it. Yeah, and then radium is the last one there. Plants have different levels of strontium depending on the bedrock where they grow, and this can be read in the bones of those who eat them. It has been thought that cremation destroyed the isotope structures, but Christopher Snock and his team from the Free University of Brussels, VUB, in Belgium found that intense heating effectively seals in some isotopic signatures. Using their new technique on 25 of the cremated individuals, the team found that at least 10 of them had strontium levels consistent with an area of Western Britain that includes Wales. Lasers used to bring up the bodies. Finding bodies buried in unmarked graves can be extremely difficult, but lasers might be able to help. To find out, Kate Coran at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee and her colleagues dug shallow pits and buried corpses of individuals who had donated their bodies for research. They used quick pulses of laser light or LIDAR to make 3D scan of the area before the bodies were buried, and then scanned again one day later, and then after 4 and 21 months. The first of these scans revealed that the grave surface became elevated a few centimetres shortly after the burial. It then shrank back down again between the second and third scans. The decrease in elevation was probably caused by the bodies decomposing in the first few months, creating more room for the soil to settle, says the researchers. The results show that investigators could narrow down possible locations in the months after grave is dug by taking two or more LIDAR scans, which can be done from the ground or even aircraft. I'd say even a drone could do that. And this is the interesting article here. Insight, DNA crime solving, family tree forensics by Chelsea White. The byline is police are using consumer DNA services to trace criminals via their relatives. Is this a genetic step too far? The Golden State Killer terrorized California with a spree of murders, rapes and burglaries between 74 and 1986. Then the killer went quiet. The case went cold, but 24th of April 2018, the Sacramento Police Department arrested Joseph James D'Angelo, an ex-police officer, in connection with the killings. His DNA led them to him and sparked a growing ethical debate. Detectives identified D'Angelo after uploading the DNA evidence from the 1980 Golden State Killer rape case to the GEDmatch, a website that's people had traced their lost relatives by adding genetic information to the genealogy database. Among the 1 million users of the service, detectives found several relatives of the killer. All were third cousins, so shared at least one set of great-great-grandparents with the Golden State Killer. Building out the family tree, they used the killer's location and approximate age to narrow down the suspect list. Although 1 million sets of DNA might seem too small a sample to find one person, considering the population is US population is 325, the investigators only needed a little luck. Janvich Elch Genetic Ancestry Company, MyHeritage, and his colleagues calculate that the database with genetic info of just 5 million people would be large enough to find a third cousin match for almost anyone white person in the US, because most people consume a genetic database fall into this ethnic group. The team hunting the Golden State Killer is one of a number of groups turning to genetic ancestry to solve mysteries. Colin Fitzpatrick at their non-profit DNA DOE project has been using a GEDmatch to find relatives of unidentified victims. We didn't know they were doing the same thing we were until we saw the news, she says. It was an idea whose time had come. Parabon Nanolabs, a biotech company, a firm in Virginia, also joined the fray after D'Angelo was arrested. All these groups use units called centimorgans to measure the similarity between two strings of DNA. One centimorgan is on an average 1 million base pairs apart. The A's and T's, C's and G's of a genetic code. The more closely related two people are, the more centimorgans of the DNA match up to the graphic on the right. Genetics firm 23andMe has found that most people have about 190 third cousins. Quote, you take a random person and this person becomes a beacon that illuminates, say, 300 peoples, their third, second, and first cousins, says Ilch. In a population of 250 million Caucasians, it doesn't take so much to illuminate everyone. In other words, genetic information relating to the majority of US population is on these databases, even though few have signed up. The legal ramifications of this are only now becoming clear. Neither privacy law nor property law is well adapted to dealing with genetic data, which are unavoidably shared among many people, says Natalie Ram of the University of Baltimore, Maryland. You could treat it like property held by a married couple, she says. One partner can't give away shared property without the other person's permission. But genetic information is so widely spread that it would be impossible to coordinate the consent of everyone who shares your DNA. The situation is evolving, but law enforcement won't want to give up this powerful tool. Police databases built with DNA analysis hold only about 20 genetic markers. With genotyping for genealogy, hundreds of thousands of markers are put to use, says C.C. Moore, a genetic genealogist of the Parabon Nanolabs, who helped solve 7 cases since D'Angelo was arrested, and not just historical cases. Quote, after the Golden State Killer case, every law enforcement agency sat up and took notice. She says, I'm still having a long list of cases waiting for my attention. Ethical issues. Consumer genetic services have been available for some time, so why are the police just starting to exploit them? Before this year, GEDmatch wasn't large enough to find distant relatives, Moore says, and it's the only database that allows access for this kind of work. Firms like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, others big enough to run such a search, don't allow police to upload forensic profiles. Curtis Roger, co-founder of GEDmatch, says the use of his database for the Golden State Killer came as a surprise. Quote, I spent 2 weeks not sleeping trying to figure out the ethics of the situations. Do we ensure the privacy of all our users is protected? Or do we go after murderers who make the lack of... make the Jack of the Ripper sound like a choir boy? In the end, he says, GedMatch doesn't have the legal resources to prevent the site from being used this way. Quote, we could have published a statement that says that we require a court order for police to use our site, but it's only words, he says. They could go ahead and do it, and they probably would. Since the use of GedMatch in the Golden State Killer case came to light, the website has updated its terms of service to inform users that their data could be used in a similar fashion. At last week, firms including 23andMe and Ancestry.com released new guidelines on how they will respond to law enforcement's requests for data. Quote, some of my colleagues in genealogy don't approve of my choice of work with the law enforcement, Moore says. She says she has been approached to do such work before. She waited until GedMatch updated its rules. Quote, I don't want to use DNA for anyone who doesn't want it used in these cases, she said. Despite uniquely identifying you, DNA records are considered in US law to be identified information that have been given to police without a court order. The law enforcers are likely to want to gather DNA from another services given the success of GedMatch. Some US states allow DNA samples to be taken from anyone who is arrested even if they are not charged for the crime. Taking part in a research trial could also mean signing away your genetic data. If you don't use these things, someone you are related to might. Quote, every year has been a record year for people uploading genetic data to these consumer sites. It goes up exponentially, says Illich. The consequence of familial databases stretches beyond criminal investigations. Undercover operatives could be revealed, and egg and sperm donors could be unmasked without their knowledge and consent. Of course, there are upsides. Holocaust survivors and adopted people have tracked down a long-lost relatives, and families have been given answers about the deceased loved ones. We now need to decide where to draw the line. Quote, if the person arrested is the Golden Gate Killer, bringing him to justice is a significant victory, says Sam. Says Ram. But a wish to solve crime cannot be our override prophecy, she adds. If police push the use of genetic data too far, there may be a backlash against genetic research and testing. Quote, I come down on the side of families of the victims, Moore says. This could also work as a deterrent. If we stop one crime, that would be worth it, she says. People can still choose a consumer genetics company that doesn't share data with the police. But none of us can avoid it for long. If the distant relative puts their DNA online, yours is out there too, whether you like it or not. Trying to go back and change that now is futile, Fitzpatrick says. Okay, genetic fact files. What was that thing? This is Suspected Brothers. In 1986, 12-year-old Michelle Welsh went missing in Tacoma, Washington. Police found her body in a ravine near a local park. She had been sexually assaulted and murdered. Police took evidence but couldn't solve the case. In May 2018, a profile of an unknown suspect's DNA led to a relative of the suspect. He was a half-cousin of two brothers. Police followed one of them, Gary Hartman, into a diner and picked up a napkin he'd used. His DNA matched the sample from her body, and the police charged Hartman with a murder and rape in the first degree. He has pleaded not guilty. It's strange, isn't it? Yeah. Executed killer. Virginia Freeman, a Texas real estate agent, was found dead in 1981 behind a home she was selling. She had been hit with a blunt object, stabbed and strangled. The detectives found DNA under her fingernails, but the case went unsolved. This year, the DNA profile generated from a sample printed onto an unknown suspect's second cousin and great-grandparents, which led to the identification of James Otto Etter, as the killer. Etter was executed in 1999 for kidnapping and murder of a 9-year-old girl, so he's already dead. I don't know. His body has been exhumed to confirm the match. Not so cold case. Most cases solved in the wake of the Golden State killer arrest are decades old, but Utah police have now used genetic genealogy to track down a suspect in a recent crime. In April 2018, a 79-year-old woman named Clara Brooks reported that a man broke into her home while she was asleep and sexually assaulted her. Police used DNA samples and genetic genealogy to find Spencer Glenn Mossett, 31-year-old Utah man, who was charged with burglary, rape and sexual assault. He was arrested on the 28th of July, just 14 weeks after the crime was committed. This comment. A Vote Against Deep Fakes by Tim Huang. AI generated hoax videos won't wreck democracy this year, as some are predicting. There is no doubt that recent demonstrations of believable fakes generated by machine learning are striking. From uncannily simulated voices to fabricated videos of political leaders, it's natural to worry that these techniques will make it easier to manipulate political discourse and public opinion. But it's worth taking a step back. Just because capability exists does not mean that it will be used widely or make a serious impact. There are good reasons to believe that, for the near future, deepfakes embedded into artificial intelligence will be limited use and have limited impact. To that end, I'm not taking part in a friendly public wager and betting that by the end of 2018 we will not have seen a political hoax generated by machine learning getting more than 2 million views before being discovered. Given that this is a year in which the US voters go to the polls again for the midterm elections, when we might expect disinformation campaigns to be likely. Why do I think I'm backing the right horse? The economics are important. The state and non-state actors using online propaganda want to achieve the most influence at the lowest cost. We need to recognise that rudimentary techniques can already have a big influence on the public discourse. Numerous incidents attest to the fact that simply reusing an old video and asserting that it's something that it's not can be sufficient to fool many people. A crude Photoshop job can spread disinformation. At the same time, AI remains a relatively costly tool for generating hoaxes. The current breakthroughs in AI rely on two major inputs, large data sets and computational power, both of which are expensive to acquire. Moreover, the technique behind the more impressive demonstrations of AI-driven fabrication known as generative adversarial networks are famously temperamental. This all suggests in the near term, AI-constructed fakes will be inferior to the existing arsenal of propaganda tools. As a result, researchers have more time to create effective methods for detecting this type of fakery. It also enables society to adjust to the knowledge that everyday video can be faked in this way, and to do so, to be on guard before widespread deployment. Ultimately, it's possible that deepfakes are a diversion from the more critical questions, or we may eventually see AI-driven hoaxes become an attractive option for technologically-minded propagandists. But it will be the draw of the underlying narratives pushed by the fakes that determines their influence. A better understanding of behavioural factors driving beliefs and hoaxes will be the only way to avoid playing an unwinnable game of technological whack-a-mole. Beautifully put. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.